Hello and welcome to the Label Sessions Presents podcast. Label Sessions is the world's leading innovation expert network. In this series, you will meet some of the most interesting leaders anywhere, from across the worlds of business, design, tech, culture, and sustainability, all signed to the Label Sessions roster. To find out more about our work, helping brands and institutions around the world take on their big challenges for the future, head to labelsessions.com to find out more. For now, enjoy the podcast.
Thank you so much for taking time to sit down and talk to me today. We know you at Label Sessions as someone who's, you know, quite a complex problem solver and does a lot of turnaround strategy, but I feel like you could give us a better insight into sort of, you know, an intro of you, your work, and the backstory that brings you to where you are today.
Sure. Yeah, so, you know, the way I got to where I am, you know, has definitely been a journey, I think. You know, I started off kind of just thinking I would study philosophy and English lit and realized that it's hard to make a living doing that, right? So, you know, but what it did kind of ground me in is like really good writing. So, people, you know, then I became like a technical writer, right? I have a degree in technical writing along with philosophy. And so when I first started out, my first job was in technical writing and it bored me to tears. Like it was really, no offense to technical writers out there, but it just really, really bored me because I realized I was having to write a lot of stuff to make up for the fact that the software that I was writing about was really, really poorly designed. So I started talking to the engineers and I started saying, hey, what if we just did it this way? You'd knock down, you know, 15 steps to 10. They would tell me I'm an idiot. Like, there's no way you could do that. The software is the way it is. You don't understand technology. So then I dove into UI tech. Like, what makes UI technology? HTML, CSS, JavaScript, all the stuff that makes, you know, at the time made things kind of work. And I realized that you could do a lot of what I was talking about. So then I would go to them and say, well, what if you did this and this? And they begrudgingly sometimes were like, okay, yeah, actually it would work like that. We didn't know we could do that. And so then I realized that like my desire really was born out of laziness. Like I just didn't really want to write as much. So then I got into design. I went to school for design and kind of understanding like the human psychology behind design, the cognitive psychology behind it. And was a design person, a UX person for a while. And again, worked out pretty well, worked for a number of software companies, different backgrounds, et cetera, but then realized that I came in consulting. Like I was after people bought things. And so what I found out was most of the time people bought stuff in the sales cycle that actually weren't the ones that had to use it. And so I was now kind of beholden to build a vision that wasn't really what people really wanted. And so I started thinking, well, what if we came earlier on? Like, what if we caught in earlier and really understood it, not from a technology perspective, but from a business perspective? What is the business problem that we're really trying to solve? That's where design thinking came in. That's where kind of helping with transformation, helping with organizational strategy, helping with organizational psychology, all those things I finally found after, you know, maybe, I guess, 18 to 20, you know, over 20 years now, finally feel like I've grown up. And like, you know, found what it is I wanted to do when I grew up. So that's kind of where.
Oh, brilliant. And, you know, for someone like yourself, who's obviously, you know, had a lot of career sort of stepping stones, yeah, and, you know, finally getting to where it is that you want to be today, do you still see all of those different steps as disconnects or like their own individual years? Or do you see them as a cumulative experience to where you are today?
Now the, you know, the hindsight 2020 kind of thing where I do see it as a number of steps. When I was in it, it was sometimes hard. You know, one of the things that I think was something that, you know, I don't think I ever set out to be a leader of people, right? To like manage people, lead people, grow people. I never thought that was a thing. The only reason why I thought I was necessary was to get a certain title and, you know, grow up in an organization and get levels of seniority to get the ability to do what you wanted to do. By necessity, that means you have to like manage large swaths of people. But what I found was that, you know, doing so, even though it wasn't something I really set out to do, kind of wove all those steps together, right? It really helped understand how to transform organizations, how to help organizations deal with strategy all the way down to granular level of like, if an individual comes to me and says like, how do I manage my career? Like, what are the next steps? You kind of are able to take a step back and really help that person. So I think, you know, when you're in it, you don't necessarily understand it. And it takes sometimes a number of steps. I always wanted to move forward. I always wanted to do some interesting stuff. So that helped ground me, even if it was maybe technically a sidestep to a career path. But understanding that the interesting nature work of that nature was really going to help you make better decisions going forward.
Brilliant. Brilliant. It's good to see it all still, you know, builds up, because sometimes with people you see it as like, that was a stepping stone, yes, but it still didn't have any sort of impact on where I am today. But it's nice to see that still, you know, even if it's not necessarily relevant, it still has an impact.
Sure.
But speaking of impact, I'd love to, you know, take us back to where you are today and talk a little bit about what is it that's exciting you right now. Obviously, you know, you're working in the realm of like sort of software development and innovation, but what opportunities do you see that are emerging in the field that you're in and think that's important?
I don't think you could talk about anything these days without trying to understand, comprehend the impact of AI and like, how's that going to help? Or how's that going to hinder?
Yeah.
Is it a threat? So embracing it really was, you know, I think early on when Gen AI came out, it was like, well, that's not going to really do anything. And like, the models aren't sophisticated. And I think that was just generally like a level of like, hey, preservation, like, you know, what we do as human beings is super important. Now, you know, quickly discarding that, understanding that like, we need to embrace this. And what does that mean for design? What does that mean for innovation? What does that mean for organizational structure and transformation? How can it help? How can it move businesses forward? Where are the points that we should not venture? Now, that concept, I think, is really an antithesis to human nature. Like, we never think like we just can't do something. I should probably say a little differently. It's not that we don't think that we can't do it. It's that it never occurs to us that maybe we should. Like, maybe we shouldn't do this. Maybe it's not good for us. I think some of those things are pushing those boundaries and asking us the question, like, what's the point of all of this, right? If we just, like, give all the keys over to the AI masters, like, what's the point of working? What's the point of doing anything? You know, like, we talk about kind of freeing up to do the hard work. Well, the problem with the hard work is it's hard. And nobody wants to do it, right? So when I kind of consult with organizations and I see people happily in spreadsheets and struggling and doing a lot of manual work, and we say, well, what if we gave you a tool that helped you? In general, people don't embrace that. They kind of say, no, I have a system, it's good. And you realize, because it's like they're in a comfort level, right? And to introduce something to take that away, that is basically forcing themselves to ask the question, well, what am I supposed to do now? What value do I have to the organization? Why do I get up every morning to do this job? So I think, you know, those are the things that are really interesting to me to help answer those questions, help solve for those challenges, help organizations move forward.
No, brilliant. I mean, it is an ever-present thing that's always going to be, you know, coming up, especially now going forward. But it's interesting to see your sort of spin on it of like, you know, quite often people talk about it as like being skeptical for so many other reasons, but never as just a form of like, you know, comfort. I have a system that works. I'm not going to change my ways kind of thing, rather than just this isn't useful enough for what I needed to do kind of thing.
Right.
But that brings me nicely into, you know, obviously AI is that one thing, but thinking of the industry that you're in, what other questions, not necessarily just AI, or do you think that leaders should be asking themselves right now?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's this huge amount of legacy software that exists in large and small organizations, mainframes, and, you know, things that are written in languages that people are not even around anymore, don't practice. And they've been patched and patched and patched and patched, and they've been kicked down the road so far. But right now, these are really like thorny, hairy systems. And when you look at them, it's easy to get kind of fearful because you're like, wow, it's not just that these are old systems. These are old systems that underpin the basic day-to-day operations of large organizations. And you're like, man, you know, if something broke, I have people on my staff that have a small amount of knowledge enough to keep it running and fix it, but they're not masters of this craft. But, you know, this is what these large digital transformation projects were all about and have struggled and failed to come to fruition because it's super, super hard, right? And you talk to some of the hyperscalers out there, AWS and Google Cloud and stuff like that, and even they are like, yeah, you know, it was really easy to modernize. It was really easy to get software from the front office up into the cloud. But these back office applications, these like ERP systems, SAP, like all of these core ledger systems and mainframe systems, you're like, it's tough. It's really, really tough. So I think, you know, that challenge, again, applying AI to that and saying, okay, if I could use those tools to be able to extract what I need and come up with a better way, will it actually help modernize? So when you look at like software markets and things like that, when they estimate the amount of, you know, dollar amount in terms of like how big these things are, a lot of the different areas, whether it's like CRM software or ERP software, BPM software, it's in the hundreds of millions and stuff like that. When you look at like these legacy systems, you're talking trillions. And so you realize that this is a massive opportunity if you could get it right. Now, many organizations, large and small, have tried. But I think this, we are at no better time than we've ever been to be able to kind of focus in on that and figure out how to modernize things and take our systems that have existed since the 80s or before up into the modern era. And I think, you know, from a technology perspective, but also from an organizational change perspective, a mindset, you know, a change mindset, being able to do that with organizations, I think it represents an exciting opportunity for people that kind of understand how that would work. And it fits in with the culture of where we are. We have no patience. We never really did, but we really have no patience now. We have no attention span. And, you know, and what our parents and our parents' parents would consider minor inconveniences, we view as like the end of the world. And so if you look like recently at like the CrowdStrike and like these updating systems, they take down reservation systems for airlines and all this kind of stuff, people are going out of their mind. Like, you know, where, like I said, whereas before it would be seen as an inconvenience and like technology is the way it is. It doesn't have to be that way, right? It doesn't really have to be that way. We don't have to be comfortable with it anymore. So I think the opportunity exists for us to really change things at a larger scale.
Yeah, the CrowdStrike situation in particular is very fascinating because am I correct in remembering that it was the biggest outage in human history?
Yeah, one of the, you know.
Or in terms of the damage.
We surpass ourselves like every time there's another outage. yeah, you know, but I mean, honestly, that illustrates the problem, right? These problems become exponential, mm-hmm. continue to grow and grow and grow. Because honestly, everything is run by computer systems. Everything is run by these types of systems now, things that we never thought of. I mean, you know, just take a car, for instance. Nobody fixes their own cars anymore because they don't know how, you know, unless you have an older car. So, I mean, it's one of these things that it underpins the importance of really making sure that we're running on modern.
And turn a little bit back to what it is that makes you tick as a leader.
Yeah.
What is it that makes you tick as a leader on a day-to-day?
You know, I think it'd be easy to say like solving complex problems and looking at things in a different way, but I really do spend a lot of time listening. Oftentimes mm-hmm. when you're in a room or a briefing and things like that, everybody kind of wants to prove that they have something valuable to say. And because they do want to prove that, which is a very natural human tendency, they tend to be very vocal without really listening. And it's not about just sitting quiet, but it's about really paying attention, being present, listening to the nuances of when, you know, people are speaking, what's their body language, how do they interact with their colleagues and everything like that. And I'm fascinated by human behavior and how it applies in business and how people really work with one another. Because all the talk about AI and all the talk about systems and business objectives and stuff like that, at the end of the day, it's all people. Human beings are still the ones buying software. Human beings are still the ones building software. Human beings are still the ones like doing all this stuff. And, you know, we tend to kind of separate business and personal, rightly so, but the same principles apply. Like generally people buy from who they like. Generally people interact with people they like interacting with. You know, people relate to other people. And so from a leadership perspective, you know, really trying to understand people. And what it is that are their motivations, what it is that they need to do to be motivated. Excuse me, because everybody learns differently. Everybody kind of works differently. I think the role of a leader is, yes, you know, you have to kind of have objectives and make sure people are marching towards those objectives. But to get that done, you have to understand the people. You have to understand their motivations. You have to understand why they would do that for you. And it goes beyond a paycheck, right? I mean, that only gets you so far. People need to believe that they are doing work that is valuable to them, valuable to society, valuable to the business, valuable to their families. You know, at the end of the day, we do jobs for money. We do it to make a living. But at the same time, we do it to feel some level of value that goes beyond monetary. And so being able to tap into that, I think, is the role and job of every leader, to help understand what makes the people that work for you and with you do the best that they can.
And that's really powerful. And it's also very honest as well, because quite often, you know, a lot of people get caught up in the fact that it's like strictly just values. There obviously is the monetary gain too, but the values are just as important, and it sort of crosses each other out, or well, that complements each other rather. And obviously you're very sure of yourself, you're very confident in yourself as a leader today, but I'd love to talk about, you know, what advice would you give to your younger Brooke?
Yeah, you should probably have taken more risks. You should probably have not been, you know, because as you get older, you tend to become risk adverse. You tend to not want to upset what you have. And you kind of realize that maybe had I taken more risks as a younger man, I would have been in a different spot, maybe a better spot, maybe a worse spot, but certainly a different spot. And I think, you know, be a little bit more okay with change. You know, I would say, like, right now I'm a very, very adaptable leader, but that can come naturally. That came very through a lot of hard work, right? So if there was some magic way of me going back and changing that, turning that dial a little bit differently towards, you know, just becoming naturally adaptable, my journey might not have been as painful, I think. You know, it's hard to say that though, because I mean, you know, the pain and the hardship and all that makes you who you are at any given moment. So it could have been bad, I guess, you know, but I think I feel safe in saying, if I went back and said, hey, you know, take more risk and understand a little bit better about the benefits of that and that it's okay. I think that's pretty safe advice to give anyone.
And that leads in nicely to one last question I have for you before we get into some quick fire questions.
Yeah, sure.
Which is, you know, taking into consideration the sort of industries that you work in and the wider world that you're in, where do you see the opportunities to really reinvent the way that things are done? Does it involve more AI? Does it involve a different sort of lane of software dev?
I think we tend to focus too much on solutions, and we tend to focus too much on technology that solves things. And we don't spend enough time in the problem space. The problem space, meaning you just kind of, you really identify, is it really a problem? Is it that important? What would happen if I did something? What would happen if I didn't do something? Staying uncomfortable in that problem space is a huge opportunity for us to change the way we really look at things. You know, if I take some of the principles of design thinking and the things like that, it's always about, like, how might we do something, or what is the problem that we're really trying to solve? It attempts to do that in sort of cutesy fashion. I would be much more forthright about it. And I've told our clients too, like, you know what? I know that you want to jump to a solution. I know you want to find that solution. You feel that you've talked about the problem so much that everyone in this room, if there's 10 people in this room right now, you might have spent 6 months feeling like you spoke about the problem and everyone understands it. But let me ask you a series of questions in maybe a different way, coming from the outside in, and I guarantee you that all 10 people will have slightly different variations of what the problem is. And if we're not 100% consistent with our colleagues on what problem we're trying to solve and how important it is, that means our solution will probably fail. And because it won't meet the needs of what the problem is. And have we really validated that the problem is the problem? Problem with that, no pun intended, is the fact that most organizations are like, no, we spent so much time on the problem. They really haven't. They really haven't delved into the problem, because there's that old saying that, like, you need to listen to understand, not listen to respond. We sit with the problem in order to come up with a solution as quickly as possible, because it's more comfortable once you have action. And that call to action and that mindset of action means you're solving the problem. But you need to really be uncomfortable with that problem. And I think that is one of the greatest ways we could look at that. It's not about technology. At some point, technology will come into play. But we are too quick to jump to technological solutions for problems that really don't exist. And that, I think, is a greater issue.
You know, that's a really interesting take, again, about thinking more about why we do what it is that we do rather than just, you know, could and should sort of thing. That ties in nicely to the quickfire questions that I mentioned before. So these range from silly to, you know, serious.
Okay.
We'll see. Starting off the first one, could your friends explain what it is that you do?
Nope. They have no idea. They don't really understand. That's been the way my whole career. Nobody truly understands what it is that, you know, you tell somebody you work for a software company, like, oh my God, can you fix my Wi-Fi? No. I'm not in IT like in that way. Yeah. You know, I mean, yeah, I could go look at it. I have some, you know, techno, you know, because I like to tinker. Sure, I could understand it. But yeah, my parents, my, you know, like friends, they don't really understand what it's
like. Well, then comes up, what comes next is, what would you want them to say then?
It's really, you know, even unless you're in that space, it is really hard to expect anybody, you know. I have a friend who's an insurance agent, right? He sells insurance. And it's just like, you know, now we have customers, you know, in the world that I work in that are insurance companies. So I could talk to him about insurance and understand things based on the software, based on how things work. But when he comes, you know, if somebody was asking him, like, what does Baruch do or whatever, you know, he's like, oh, you know, that software we use, it's like so problematic and troublesome. And like, you know, he's like, he works in that area. You know, and so what would I like them to say? Probably that, you know, we understand a lot about workflow. We understand about kind of how people do their work. And we try to make it easier for them to do that work and try to link systems together and make sure that they have the information they need to help make decisions, to help with all sorts of stuff. But that's actually really, really hard, you know, for anyone to like expect. I think, like when I work with clients and everything like that, the greatest thing that they ever could say about the work that I do is that, you know, I help them see things in a different way so that they can solve their problems. Is that a job? Yeah. In this economy and stuff like that. Yeah. That's a super big job. I guess the closest thing people would say is that, like, you know, the closest anyone's ever gotten it right is like, oh yeah, you know, he's like a management consultant. He comes in and helps us understand our organization, helps us move forward, helps us get out of our own narrow-minded focus and looks at things in a different way. And if somebody could say that, then I'm like, okay, that's good enough for me. You don't need to know all the intricacies, just like I don't need to know all the intricacies of what it is that you do. So
that leads to the next one, which is, you know, you've given some great advice over the past sort of half an hour. I would love to know, what's the best piece of advice that someone's given you?
Best piece of advice someone's given you. Basically, it's a riff on the whole, like, you know, basically it was like, you know, if you're the smartest person in the room, you got to find a different room. Which, you know, to me always meant, you know, there's always something to learn. There's always somebody to learn from. You should never become comfortable that, you know, you shouldn't always be the mentor to people. You should be a mentee your whole life, not just work. You know, you want to do woodworking, find a woodworker, right? You know, I recently had work done on like steps in my house, like masonry outside. I don't know anything about masonry. The guy that did it, old, you know, been doing it for 30, 40 years, understanding the intricacies of how those things work and spending time outside, like talking with them, just gave me great insight into how things are put together structurally. You know, I'm not a mason. I never will be. I'll probably never do masonry in my life, but understanding some of that stuff, you realize everything's part of a system, and you know, you can make analogies, and you know, everything's kind of relatable. So that's been great advice. And I think another piece of the advice is, like, look for commonality, that, you know, because I work in a whole bunch of different industries, everyone feels that they're super kind of exclusive and they're super, you know, special. Everyone wants to believe that they're special. But really, I mean, we're only solving for a small amount of problems in the world as it relates to software, what software actually does. And so if I talk to a banking customer one day and a consumer services customer the next day, even though they're in vastly different businesses, chances are they're trying to solve a lot of the same problems. So being able to relate and find common ground is super helpful, right? To be able to do that.
And both really good pieces. And then that brings me to, what is one thing that you could not live without? Doesn't have to be, it could be personal, it could be professional.
Yeah. You know, good food, I think. I'm not a eat to live kind of person. I'm more live to eat kind of guy. So I think, if there wasn't good food around and stuff like that, I think we're pretty lucky to have the most availability of like good food that we've ever had. And being able to kind of, you know, get together with people to be able to do that, share experiences, whether it's, you know, with your family or friends and stuff like that, I think it's just, if that went away tomorrow, it'd be a huge hole in my life.
Oh, there'd be a huge hole in my heart, honestly. I'm very much on the same page. Live to eat, honestly. So much better that way.
Right.
I never understand people who treat it as just fuel.
Yeah, absolutely.
But then the last thing I have for you is, and it's a question that we ask everyone, it's sort of a trademark, is on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being the most, how weird are you, Brooke?
How weird? pretty weird, I would think. I don't know, probably an 8. Say an 8. 8's good.
Solid number. Yeah. Well, that's a great place to leave it for now. I just wanted to say thank you so much for your time. I really do appreciate it. Looking forward to what's next.
All right. Thank you so much for the time, too. Appreciate it.
As we close out another episode, make sure to like, subscribe, and follow us on our social channels. Want to access Label Sessions for your brand? Whether you want to build new products, access world-class mentors for your team, or reinvent the way you attract talent into your business, visit Label Sessions to find out more.